Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, on this October the 30th on the West Coast and October the 31st on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. I will be with you for the next hour. We would like to welcome those who are listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network as well as BlogTalkRadio.com, especially all those in the military who have been tuning in lately. I'd like to give a special shout-out to some friends, Karen, Bob, and Bill, David, Sheila, Zachariah, Crenshaw, Sylvia, Jill, the General, and anyone with Project Alliance who's listening into this show tonight. We appreciate the work that you're doing and the ways you're helping us out. And we are making headway, it seems. I have a little story to share with you before I bring tonight's guest on. And this comes from a Canadian expatriate who spent a living over some 20 years in Japan. And he has been writing several books in Japanese. He's made some declarations that he was offered a position as the finance minister of Japan. Don't know if that's true or not, but there was some recent analysis of some of his writings and some things he was saying in radio interviews, and some reverse speech studies were done on those interviews, and appeared he was telling the truth. But we have all kinds of conflicting information about the world's financial status, and we're just trying to sort through some things. International Currency Review publisher and editor Christopher Story published a scathing report about the financial corruption, as he has been for the past 3 years or so. And normally he used to report on market trends and things like that, things that were happening in the international business community, things with exchange rates and the goings on of the world's central banks and credit and all those issues that affect the world's economy. And he's had to focus for the past 3 years on corruption, and we've talked about that many times on the show. I wrote a piece about Wantagate, which was sort of a recapitulation of many of the financial scams that went on since the late 80s, 1980s, all the way up to the present, really. And we've been talking about that a lot, and it's turned out that Ambassador Leo Wanta basically was working for the Bush cabal, who I've outed as the sheriffs. And recently, Benjamin Fulford has been writing about this corruption, the prosperity payments that are due to people who invested in Nasara. And because of some of Fulford's writings, Chris Story wrote a scathing article about a lot of websites that are basically intelligence-backed or intelligence-controlled websites that put out some truth and a lot of bunk. And I thought you might find this short little piece that Benjamin Fulford wrote about these goings-on and the article that Chris Story wrote about him, exposing him as a disinformation agent, and you know, you can draw your own conclusions. There is some truth in this article, but I can tell you that Mr. Fulford suddenly has become as important as the long-legged Mac Daddy in Washington, D.C., and it just doesn't make sense to me. This is called More About the Queen, and this was published on Benjamin Fulford's blog site. And I quote, "It seems I have upset the Queen of England with some of my recent writings. If the reactions of her bulldog, Christopher Story, are anything to judge by. Although Story has said in the past his phone number is listed, and to please call him, he did not answer any of several calls made to him, nor did he call me back. So let me explain why I wrote what I did about her. Basically, as a journalist, if I hear from reliable, authoritative sources information that I feel the public deserves to know, I publish it. Clearly, the Bush-Clinton faction revealed every piece of dirt they could find on her in order to derail her in her efforts to jumpstart the new financial system. Now that her dirty laundry has been hung out in public, they have nothing left to blackmail her about, except Diana, but everybody knows anyway. As I mentioned previously, a lawyer representing the Queen and a Dragon Group contacted me and asked me to pressure the Bank of Tokyo Mitsubishi, UFJ. They needed a shorter name, how about BUTM, into releasing $2.13 trillion bond. Then he says they did, and the money ended up in the pockets of Papa Bush and his whole gang instead of being spent on developing suppressed technology and turning the deserts green as promised. After this, a flurry of angry insiders came out of the woodwork and supplied me with dirt on the Queen. They thought they had been betrayed. If she did not deliberately give the money to the Bush Nazis, but rather had it seized illegally, then I owe her a majestic, or I owe Her Majesty a royal apology. In any case, the latest I hear from the Queen's lawyers that the Queen of England and Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands and most of the Bilderbergers are now aligned against the Thule Society Nazis under Papa Bush. We will know if this is true when they show us with deeds and not promises." Now, I have that end of quote, by the way, end of the article. Personally, I have a few issues. If he did get in touch with lawyers from the Queen and the Dragon Group, may have been regarding a defamation suit. I don't know. Certainly, a journalist is not the person to put pressure on the Bank of Tokyo Mitsubishi, especially when it comes to convincing them to fork out a $2.13 trillion bond. It just doesn't wash with me. That's my opinion on the matter. You decide for yourself. Now, I bring this up because there is another article or series of articles that have been flying about the last few days, and it's over allegedly Obama has signed off. This is the type of information that's out there. You be the judge. He signed off the presidency to China through the Secretary of Commerce due to a default on a $1 trillion loan. Now, stop and think. There have been recent reports in looking at the massive derivative and hedge fund corruption that's going on with the central banks, not just in New York and on Wall Street, not just with the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury and the SEC's complicity in all of this, but this is involving international banks all over the place. Anybody willing to do business on the promise of a few $1 billion kickback money when they're able to launder money, move it into different accounts, and basically steal it from the American people. $1 trillion is not even a drop in the bucket when you consider that it's probably over $5 quadrillion now in bogus derivatives and hedge funds. Consider that it takes 31,710 years to count up to a trillion, one second at a time. This replaces a second with a dollar, and then multiply that by 5,000 times. And that's how long it takes to count five, and I've heard figures as high as $5.5 quadrillion. If it's only $1 quadrillion, it's unimaginable. But imagine that on promises of up to 5,000% return on money, and these are the types of deals that are being offered to people out there to take these junk bonds that are absolutely worthless while they steal our real estate, while they steal our public funding, and while they tax us to death, and while they come up with new ways to charge us money for whatever insanity they can devise. So the likelihood that the presidency would be signed over for $1 trillion is very slim. And I've had this conversation with a few people this week, and I thought I'd bring it up because the articles are starting to fly now. It's another diversion. It's like the bird flu. It's like the swine flu. It draws your attention away from what's really going on. Let's get to the foundational question. We have somebody who can't even prove they're an American sitting in the White House. Can't prove they're an American because they're not an American. And they're being given this kind of authority. This is just corruption, folks. Think about it. And I'd like to dedicate this next song to the long-legged Mac Daddy from New Guinea.
Years ago when I was 23, I was married to a widow who was pretty as could be. This widow had a grown-up daughter who had hair of red. My father fell in love with her and soon they two were wed. This made my dad my son-in-law and changed my very life. For my daughter was my mother cause she was my father's wife. To complicate the matter, even though it brought me joy, I soon became the father of a bouncing baby boy. My little baby then became a brother-in-law to dad, and so became my uncle, though it made me very sad. For if he was my uncle, then that also made him brother to the widow's grown-up daughter, who of course was my stepmother. I'm my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. It's a funny, I know, but it really is so. Oh, I'm my own grandpa. My father's wife then had a son who kept him on the run. He became my grandchild cause he was my daughter's son. My wife is now my mother's mother and it makes me blue. Because although she is my wife, she's my grandmother too. If my wife is my grandmother, then I am her grandchild. And every time I think of it, it nearly drives me wild.
This has got to be the strangest thing I ever saw.
As husband of my grandmother, I am my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. Everybody!
Now, to think that I spent a year and a half doing the genealogy on Barack Obama and John McCain, and this one song does it in about 3 minutes, is astounding. Anyway, with that, we're going to bring back tonight's guest. He's a regular guest on Evident Footprints every Friday. He's our resident science advisor because he is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and he's my co-host, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. That's quite a set of lyrics there, if you can follow it.
yeah. It makes sense.
I only have one comment regarding the whole Obama issue this evening. I saw a bumper sticker, or would-be bumper sticker, that I thought was pretty funny, and it was regarding the race issue, the racist card, or whatever you want to call it. And apparently it was written by white folks, and they said, well, we're not racist. We don't like his white side either.
Yes, and, you know, I heard that that's actually a sign on a restaurant, too, someplace in Texas.
Well, that's a good place for it.
Oh, man.
Texans are pretty open about stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, that's really what we have in Washington right now, and I thought, you know, a little bit of humor would make the pill, the bitter pill, easier to swallow. That's really the issue. That is the fundamental issue here, and they're avoiding it like crazy. Now, Orly Tate's lawsuit was dismissed, I heard. I haven't seen the actual court documents, but I had heard something that there were some shenanigans played to convince the judge to dismiss the case, which has pretty much been par for the course. And I made the prediction at least a month ago that that's how this case was going to end. They were going to dismiss it. You see, this is there's too much at stake. The Illuminati have invested too much in this whole plot to take over the Earth, and they're very scared that they're falling apart, like rats in a sack. You know, if what Benjamin Fulford has said it is true, that the Bilderbergers and the Thule Society, which really should have been called the Dachau DVD, because the Thule Society is really not the upper echelon of what's going on with, you know, Nazi Germany and their desire to have a Fourth Reich, a thousand year Reich, here in the United States. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but all of this stuff is beginning to tie together. If you notice, every week it seems like we've connected more dots. Do you find that to be true?
Oh, absolutely. I've noticed it. I've been following it as best I can. Of course, you know, I can only dedicate so much time every day to it because I'm steeped in other pursuits, but. It's funny you should mention the thing about the Fourth Reich and whether or not I'm aware of that. Of all people, our dear friend Randy gave me a book about the rise of the Fourth Reich. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I perused it. And, man, it nails a lot of the stuff that you've been coming out with right on the head. And, of course, that's what every American needs right now is a Nazi in every closet. But... whatever's going to happen is happening, that's for sure. And I think that the forces that have been mustered in this whole thing, and which appear to now have taken sides, make it an inevitable outcome of some kind. It's either going to be another massive war, God forbid. I don't think there's enough money for that, though, myself. Or the thing is just going to come down, and there's going to be a lot of necks stretched in the long run. And that's the outcome I'm praying for.
Yeah. Well, they certainly have created the munitions to carry out, you know, another war. They've got enough nuclear weapons to destroy the whole planet. But, you know, they've, as you said, they don't have enough money, let's say, to pack up and head off to Mars or the moon. Although that's going on. You know, they're not in a position to do that without some repercussions somewhere. And they've got the problem of all the people that are waking up and paying attention to what's going on. And people are starting to really get fed up. It's becoming an apolitical issue, a non-issue about Democrat and Republican. You're always going to have those people that are just, you know, so much in the box that they're not going to get out of it, and they're not going to see anything. In terms of what's going on within this big huge cabal that likes to call themselves the Illuminati or the Committee of 300 or whatever name you want to give them, it really doesn't matter. Because there are a lot more of us than there are of them, and we're all being affected by the changes that are taking place in the universe. And they have spent thousands of years hiding the history from us, hiding facts about who the races that have been here, the extraterrestrial origins of many of the beings that they're finding. as well as the technology. And that's what you and I have been talking about for the past few weeks. And I want to turn the mic over to you so you can continue with your wonderful presentation.
Well, okay. Yeah, I definitely feel that this attempt to throw some light on some of the extraordinary things in our past, which mirror a lot of the things that you just spoke about, cannot help but at least broaden consciousness a little bit if people will only take the time to ponder these issues. And by the way, any kind of subject that I mention in this presentation, as in the previous 2 or 3 weeks' presentations also, there's an ocean of information about it out there if you just, you know, pick up your mouse and start searching on the web. These are not things which I just blunder about and blurt out. This is information which has been longstanding and captivated my interest many, many years ago. But now there seems to be even more accessibility to these facts, considering, you know, the power of the Internet and how many people are digging around for unusual facts. And so with that, I would like to mention that last week we left off on the subject of medical accomplishments in the ancient past. And there's an awful lot of information on this subject. Brain surgery in Peru and in Mexico, and we know that this was done because the skulls that show these entry points have also healed, and new bone has filled in where they where the brain had been worked on, and that can't happen if the surgery wasn't successful. So we at least know the patients lived. Don't think we know too much about why they were operated on, although the holes that have been bored in the skull are in a number of different positions in different skulls that have been found. So it apparently wasn't all for the same reason. And of course, also there's an enormous amount of early medical information in the medical papyrus found in Egypt. And I think we mentioned the fact that there was a gentleman named Shwala de Lubitz, who spent his entire lifetime piecing together information about the true nature of Egypt's culture and all of the marvelous things that he discovered over a 60-year period of digging into the incredible depth of knowledge that they have. And this was reflected not only in the way they built their temples and things of that nature, but also it was a reflection of very basic natural principles which appear not only in the design of their buildings and in the philosophies that they held, but apparently which mirror higher aspects of nature which are lost to us in our culture. There's just no way you'd even comprehend the kinds of things that were done and the way people thought about reality in that time period. But you can get a glimmer of this if you read Shwala de Lubitz's famous book called The Temple of Man. And it's actually a two-volume work, and it's pretty intense reading, I'll be honest with you. Do you have any comments on that, Don?
No, I'm just following along with you. I'm getting text messages as you're speaking, and I'll bring these issues up in a little bit, but now's not the appropriate time, so just continue.
Okay, fine. Another subject which is really worth giving consideration to, especially in terms of broadening the consciousness, are ocean crossings before Columbus. Now, you know, we have had it drilled into our heads that Columbus discovered America, and everything proceeded in a very linear fashion from then. And, you know, the date of 1492 is the point where the world has really been changed by the efforts of this great explorer. Well, that's all well and good, but there's problems with it because there's numerous I'm just talking about numerous traits of other information that suggest that the not only the Atlantic but also the Pacific have been crossed numerous times by numerous groups of people. We know the Vikings were here. There's no question about that. They landed certainly as far north as Newfoundland, but my work with Ivan Sanderson years ago suggested that they may have penetrated, come down the St. Lawrence River into the Great Lakes systems, and they may have penetrated into our territory as deeply as Minnesota, northern Minnesota. And then, of course, there was a famous Irish monk, Brendan the Navigator, who sailed from Ireland looking for the lost island called High Brazil. And there's a very strong possibility that they landed in New England. There's ruins there of a thing called the Irish Tower, which many people feel was built by Brendan and his followers. And then, of course, the Persians were here. There's no question about that. They landed in Brazil, and there's even one of their noblemen supposedly buried in a very unusually carved giant face that's in a mountain overlooking one of the harbors down there, and they found ancient writing there that's seems to be reflecting the Phoenician culture. On the West Coast, we know that the Chinese have been here. We know that the Japanese have been here. And these crossings and these settlements and whatnot, and possibly trade, by the way, certainly predate Columbus. But one of the things that's really amazing is there are two pretty important commodities, which were obviously traded in considerable volume, and they definitely necessitated transatlantic crossings by peoples from the Mediterranean area, particularly the Egyptians and possibly the English or whoever was in England before that time. I can't remember all the different factions that were involved, but anyway, there are a lot of artifacts that were from the Bronze Age, particularly swords, knives, shields, and things of that nature, which had to be made, you know, of proper alloys. And the tin that's in the bronze from some of these eras have been traced to Bolivia. And what's really amazing is that when the Portuguese first came into, the region which is now Brazil, there were still lingering trade routes that suggested commerce from various regions of the Andes as far away as Lake Titicaca, coming all the way down through trails in the jungle and across the mountains and winding up in the eastern part of Brazil, near the mouth of the Amazon. And it's very possible that there was once a trade route that went from there across the Atlantic and wound up not only in England, but also in the area that we now know as Egypt. And that's, like I said, is verifiable by tracking the molecular structure of the tin, which has definitely been identified as coming from Bolivia. But that's not the only product. Mummies that have been investigated in Egypt in various burials have found cocaine in their bloodstream, which, of course, in those days was only available from South America. So there was an awful lot of stuff going on, in the early period before the so-called traditional history, which is definitely worthy of note. And some of those things certainly constitute situations which should be pondered upon, because obviously history is much different than what we decide we want to accept. Wouldn't you think so, Don?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay, well, moving on, we have another interesting mystery, if you want to call it that, and that is the, we've all heard about Bigfoot, the Yeti, and all of these sightings of some other kind of humanoid, which seems to be coexisting with us on the planet, even though we have moved into a reasonably civilized period where these things would only be considered as boogeymen. But nonetheless, the reports keep rolling in. And some of the people that are a little bit more daring in their thinking have asked the question, well, let's assume that they exist. What could they be? You know, what are these creatures? How do they fit into the scheme of things? And there's one interesting theory, of course, that that the creatures called Sasquatch, Yeti, Bigfoot, or whatever, may be existing descendants from Gigantopithecus, or, you know, some giant ape-type creature. And remains of such have been found, of course, and classified in the fossil record. But the theory that makes the most sense to me, quite frankly, is that it might just be that there are factions of Neanderthal man still living in various isolated places. We don't really know too much about them, except from their remains and the few artifacts that have been found. But what's really interesting about all this is that in the Ural Mountains, there have been, for quite some time, a fairly large tribe, if you want to call it that, or settlement, of creatures of this type. Not necessarily as big and lumbering as these Sasquatch reports would indicate, but perhaps a smaller, more benign subspecies, if you will. And they are referred to locally as the Alma. And the Alma keep to themselves. They apparently have a very primitive society of some sort. They obviously lack any type of metalworking capability and things of that sort, but they trade with the local people in that region. And I guess they give them herbs and other things like that in return for pottery and bits of metal and beads and things of that sort, which they have no way of making. And this has been going on for a very long time. As a matter of fact, there's two books written on the subject. One of them was mentioned earlier on a different show called The In Pursuit of Unknown Animals by Bernard Houvelmont. But the other one is called They Still Live, and it specifically targets the tribe of the Alma, and it's very well worth reading. I forget the name of the author, unfortunately, but I have a copy of the book in my library back in New Jersey. And it's a fascinating story. Now, also, another person who lends credence to the possibility that more primitive subhuman types are still living, and this discounts the primitive subhuman types that occupy Washington. I'm talking about more remote areas.
Go ahead, continue.
We have reports from Colonel Fossett when he was in the very backward regions in Brazil and up the Amazon and various places, that he ran into a tribe that was so primitive that they didn't have organized speech, and they just communicated by grunts and howls and things of that sort. And
like those in Washington. Go ahead.
And so, anyway, those creatures are still floating around probably down there in certain regions. And locally, they're referred to as the bat people because they live in burrows that they hollow out on the sides of hills, and they are cannibalistic. So those types of things definitely cause one to ponder the possibilities of our world being very different from the way we perceive it. And what's really interesting is, if you have the flexibility of mind to do so, you should try to place your consciousness into a group of these subhuman individuals, like the Alma, for instance, or these South American bat people, whatever they may be, and realize that in the regions where they exist, they have no concept whatsoever of something like New York, or something like a computer, or electricity, or any of the things that we take for granted that we feel are the hallmarks of the modern world. And, you know, if you just start thinking about that, it's a heck of a trip, because you start to realize that right on our own planet, we have levels of consciousness so low that for all intents and purposes, they occupy the Stone Age. They certainly reflect a Stone Age mentality or a Stone Age consciousness, whatever you want to call it. And if you just do a comparison between these two types in your mind, I realize it's only a mental experiment, you get an idea of how vast a spectrum of consciousness exists. That brings up to mind, too, Don, the story about the natives down in New Guinea during World War II, when they used to see these cargo planes coming in, supplying the various islands where they built runways as we advanced towards the invasion of Japan. And they couldn't quite comprehend what was going on, but they saw these big birds coming in, and they saw the unloading of all these goods and all these unusual things coming out of them, and then they'd fly away again. And then, of course, after the war, it all stopped. And so they in mimic of this, built huts and fake runways and put torches along them to represent landing lights and built planes out of bamboo and wood and put them out there, hoping to attract back these birds of the gods. So, you know, all of this kind of stuff goes on, and we have such a mixture of consciousness here on the planet. It occupies very well-established pigeonholes that you should be able to realize by thinking about these things and comparing them to your own way of life, just how diverse consciousness can be to begin with. And then you realize that if there's that much distance below the strata which we occupy, how much is left above us to explore?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I know, Don, you've given a lot of time and thought to.
Yeah, I'd like to comment. Actually, there's a couple of things that you've been talking about that I'd like to comment on. Just temporarily, going back to when you mentioned Columbus and the natives seeing his ships arrive, just 2 days ago, I did a show with Truat, and his guest, his actual scheduled guest, was Dr. Michael Castle, and he is a chemist, and he's been studying chemtrails and lots of other things. He's been studying the ET phenomena. And I'm going to have him on this show. He's got some remarkable information, and I think you would also find him to be very interesting. And he brought up something that I remember reading or hearing many years ago about the the indigenous people here in America, when Columbus's ships first arrived, they didn't even see the ships. It was outside their realm of consciousness and their experience, so they didn't even see them. They actually had to meet the people that were on the ships first to comprehend what was going on. So you can imagine the culture shock and the shift in consciousness that took place. Now, I remember learning in school, and of course, we learned lots of things that we're finding out aren't true. But I remember Vespucci being credited actually for discovering America. He was a cartographer. The Wikipedia biography of him actually gives the credit to Columbus and insinuates that somehow Columbus came here to the to what's now the United States in 1492. And that Vespucci must have come later. Well, we saw in your research and the research of others, even my own research, that Marconi was credited for many of Tesla's inventions. Edison was basically mimicking some of the things that Tesla did or was just totally off track of Tesla's ideas. Tesla was so far ahead. And you wonder why these stories are never just plain and simple. You know, there should be a simple record that's indisputable about these things, but everybody has to take credit. Somebody has to be in control. Now, that's my comment on that issue, and you can comment in a few minutes or a couple of minutes if you choose to. The other thing is, Sasquatch. I never hear anybody consider the possibility, and I hear this discussion on many other shows. I've read some things about it. You know, if you want to call them the abominable snowman or Sasquatch or a Yeti, what about the possibility that they have discovered, let's say, a carcass that may have been frozen? Much like what they're doing with the swine flu pandemic, you know, these bioengineered diseases that are done in labs, what's the possibility that they've actually cloned some of those creatures and just turned them loose to see how they survive? What do you think about that?
Well, anything is possible, but the interesting thing that corpses have been discovered, as a matter of fact. The thing that's interesting, when I was with Ivan years ago, one of the most perplexing cases was the one where, I forget if it was in Minnesota or Michigan, but somewhere up in the northern part of the middle country, one of those critters was shot. And the interesting thing is that it was put in a refrigerated... van or something, in a block of ice, and the guy paraded it around for quite some time and made a lot of money off of it. And when Ivan went to see it, you know, being a very accomplished zoologist, the question that was posed to him was, is this some kind of a rubber dummy inside the block of ice, or is it something real? And in his book, one of his books, he discloses the entire investigation that he did on this topic, and he noted that you could see where the bullet entered, you could see where it came out on the back. The creature was in a really unusual position. Apparently he had fallen after being shot. If I remember correctly, one of his arms was either broken or cut. And you could see the bone. There were a whole series of details that you know, that he, I think there was even blood in the water that, you know, later froze into ice when this guy was packing this thing around the country. At any rate, there's a whole series of details on this subject, which Ivan commented on, and he believed that it was real. Now, it's interesting what you say, you know, that could they ever have found a corpse? Well, the reason I brought this up is because eventually when this guy started to attract too much attention, he was visited by, you know, whoever those people are that come to visit you when they're ticked off, and the exhibit was confiscated, never to be seen again. What does that mean? You know, well, it's probably in the basement of the Smithsonian somewhere. And if they have it, then they could certainly clone it. But the interesting thing is, if these are normal beings that reproduce the way we do, why would you have to clone it? I'm certain that they must mate with their own kind. The reports about them still come rolling in. It's not like they've stopped. It's just that the interest is now shifted to other, you know, to other more important things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in the I'm sort of jumping around here, but in this interview that I did 2 days ago with Dr. H. Watt and Dr. Mike Castle, Mike Castle brought up the fact that he's seeing this race of people that's covertly being created through cloning technology and the advanced nanotechnologies that they can apply to sort of these Frankenstein-like themes of creating new beings, but creating hybrids. He's also saying that there's a type which he's calling sinbreds. In other words, these are all soulless beings. They're created to be like the hive, part of the hive mentality. And if any of those beings steps out, and this would include the grays as well. And he says you can spell sin, S-Y-N, sinbred, or S-I-N. He said, I prefer the S-I spelling. you know, because they're used really for evil intents. Now, I'm not saying that these creatures are necessarily evil. It could likely be that they're sort of in an environment that's actually controlled. It may not appear to be controlled to us, but to the being itself, because of how it's created, it's operating in a hive mentality. So it hangs out by a certain area of a woods or a forest in the vicinity of a certain mountain or a certain cave or a certain underground base. Who knows? There certainly seem to be lots of strange creatures appearing, and the accounts, you know, one can conclude two things. They're either true or they're totally made up. When the Sasquatch approaches people, it's usually described as being very lumbering and sluggish or sloth-like in its movements, yet it has this capacity to escape and not be able to be tracked or found. Somehow it gains an overdrive gear in its movements, and people can't keep up with it. You know, it makes you wonder if the stories themselves are made up, but certainly there has been enough proof to show that these beings exist. And if they're that capable of hiding and not getting caught and able to reproduce and survive who knows how long, then they've got to have some kind of intelligence that enables them to be evasive like that. I mean, we don't always logically think these things through entirely. We tend to follow the storyline that we're presented with, and we don't consider, you know, how these things exist.
Well, that's an interesting line of thought that you bring up. Let me respond to that by telling you an interesting story that Ivan told me. I wish that I could have gone with him on some of these expeditions, but he had already done most of that before I met him, and he was already in bad health in those years, and so he was more or less just recounting these things and publishing them in books for other people's benefit at that time. So I missed out on some of the original adventures, but he told stories about how he and others looked for some of these creatures. As a matter of fact, one of the most thorough books ever written on the subject is called Abominable Snowman Legend Come to Life, and I have an autographed copy of it from Ivan, which I'm very proud of. And that book is at least 3 inches thick, and it should be read by anybody that's interested in this subject, because it goes into great detail about all of the stuff that's been investigated, all of the different types of creatures of this sort that have been classified, and where they have, where their habitats are around the world. So it's a very interesting and thorough book. But the story I was going to relate is this. You know, we do things in a certain way that reflects the inbreeding of our culture and our way of life, and doesn't necessarily transmit to us the error of our ways. And one of the things that, and also, even though Ivan was the one who told me this story I'm about to relate, Colonel Fossett mentions this also in his writings. But take a typical expedition that's heading in to the North Country to look for a Sasquatch. Now, what do? Well, we bring all the junk that we normally think we need for that type of thing so that we're burdened down with all kinds of things. We're afraid of what we're doing, so we bring our high-powered rifles and ammunition, and we probably go in numbers because, again, we're concerned about what we might encounter, and the strength in numbers. And actually, all these things are mistakes. First of all, you've got to consider that a being of this sort, if it's truly a creation of nature living on its own in the Northwest Territory, which is, you know, pretty remote and pretty wild in some places, even today, is going to have a lot better eyesight, a lot better hearing, and an incredible sense of smell. Now, experiments were done to show that not only Sasquatch, but even normal game, like, deer and various types of game animals. I'm not familiar with that, you know, to mention a whole list of them, but whatever they are particularly acute in their sense of smell, and they can detect the smell of gun oil, the smell of metal, because it's completely outside their normal realm of experience. You know, the smell of our clothing, the smell of boots, the sounds that go along with an approaching band of people. And they don't wait to see what it is. Their instincts tell them whatever is coming is no good, and they leave the area. So, just to give you an example, gun oil, the esters in gun oil can float on the air for, you know, a half a mile or more and be smelled by a variety of animals. And there's no reason for them to wait till you get there. If they smell something that's that foreign and their instincts are keen enough, they'll just turn and leave. So it isn't necessarily that they can run, you know, outrun you or whatever, but they know you're coming long before you get there, and so they don't hang around. On the other hand, the philosophy that Ivan embraced was small expeditions, as little equipment as possible, very few metallic objects, and be as quiet and as natural as possible. And they used to ripen themselves before they went into the woods and into the jungle. And what I mean by that is that they wouldn't bathe for days. They'd rub soil on their clothes and on themselves. They'd roll in the leaves. They'd sweat. They'd, you know, sleep outdoors. They'd do all these things. and then they would quietly go into the woods so that they smelt like another woods creature. And that's why they had results that nobody else had. And this is the kind of thing that people don't think about. It's a consciousness issue. Let's face it. And
Yes. Another thing that comes to mind, too, is, and I've got a couple of pictures on my website. They're the European Space Agency photos of Mars. And you can see a couple of bipedal beings standing near some rocks. And the very first time I saw one of these photos, I thought that looks an awful lot like Sasquatch. The general shape and appearance of the being standing up against a big rock, and another one lying down. Now, it's difficult to tell because of the amount of obfuscation in natural color tones and that, but there will come a time very soon when what I've been saying about Mars will be known to everyone. We're sort of preempting this planned announcement. There's been a mention that it may occur in late December of this year. But we've beaten them to the punch. I mean, you were on the show when we got a call from space. And we had another one in July. I only bring that up because there is evidence in other places that, there are some creatures standing around and they've been photographed. Certainly, these beings weren't wearing clothes, and it's so obscured in terms of photographic quality that you can't really make out in great detail what it is you're looking at, but it has all the earmarks of a mammal, a bipedal mammal. So I just thought I'd bring that up because this is not the only place in the universe where there's biological life forms of any kind, including those in the animal kingdom.
Well, I agree with you. As a matter of fact, listening to your story reminds me of something interesting. Years and years ago, I met a gentleman in New York City by the name of Dr. Fondiller. I think he's dead now. I haven't heard from him in many years. But he was involved in all kinds of independent research also. And one of the things he showed me, which has stuck in my head all these years, was that somebody apparently did a camera study of the night sky with a very long-term, low-intensity photographic method, that the thing was opened every night at the same time and allowed to be exposed for so many hours or whatever, and then shut off. And then the following night at the same time, the plate was re-exposed. And this went on for a period, I forget if it was 6 months or a year. I don't remember exactly, it's so long ago. But the reason it was done was because they were trying to find out if there was an overall pattern that was created by the interaction of all of the various pinpoints of light that we see from our perspective and the motion of the Earth in the course of a 1 year. At any rate, whatever they were trying to do, the results were pretty astounding. The picture that was generated when this plate was exposed looked exactly, and I mean so close, of course, that I'm not an expert in anatomy of any way, shape, or form, but I've seen enough pictures that I know that this made the hair in my head stand up when I saw it. The total exposure reproduced in white lines the total nervous system of a human being. not the bones, not the skeleton, you know, not the blood system, but the nervous system. And there was a very good-sized poster of this, or photograph of this. It was probably 24 by 48 in his office. And when I saw it, I didn't know what it was. And I said, why would you have a picture of the human nervous system against a totally black background? And that's when he related the story of how that image was produced. Now, if that's true, and I didn't follow up on it because I don't know what his source was for that image, but if that's true, that's an amazing and absolutely thought-provoking result from an experiment, and it should be duplicated by other people.
It's as though it represents the pathways of consciousness from the Creator to humanity.
Well, it definitely shows that something is going on which we don't know about, and that the human form, or at least the bipedal form, is somehow ingrained in the universe, at least from Earth's perspective. Now, who knows what you'd see if you did that on another planet, but the point is that that was not only a result which was not anticipated, but once it was demonstrated to be so, I don't know why the heck that wasn't in every newspaper on the planet. I mean, that's really something to crow about.
Yeah, well, I mean, my intuition tells me merely he took a picture of the vibratory rate that results in a human being. It's information, it's light, and it's what gives us and sustains life. What else could it be?
Well, I don't know, but I never forgot it, and I've always been looking for some tidbit of information that would allow me to go back and reinvestigate that. So if there's anybody listening who's even remotely heard about that, you contact Don and let them know, because I know the gentleman that showed this to me has passed away many years ago, and so I can't get the story from the horse's mouth anymore. But if anybody's even remotely heard of this, I would sure like to know about it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, now, Jim, I've been notified that we've got to sort of wrap the show here. I got a message that came through the chat window from Nancy saying that there's a new TV program airing on November the 2nd at 10 p.m. I don't know what time zone that is. Let's presume it may be in every time zone at 10 p.m. on the Travel Channel. And it's a special on Michael Rockefeller's disappearance. Don't you find that interesting after the research I did on how they faked his disappearance?
Yeah, that is interesting.
Yes, and there was supposed to have been a film produced by Charlton Heston's son, Fraser Heston, and Agamemnon Films. It was to come out this fall. A movie about the disappearance of Michael Rockefeller, and I may have thrown a wrench into that because of my disclosures. I don't know about you, but the Travel Channel is not necessarily the most how should I say this? Because I've seen some shows on the Travel Channel, and if you're into looking at German villages or primitive cultures in island territories and that, you know, it can be quite interesting to see some of the things they put together. But when a cameo style network that is doing feature stories on buildings and things like that gets into the realm of power people, you know, the Illuminati elite's offspring and their disappearance, somehow to me it's a bit pre-staged. It has to be. What are they going to show us? I argue all the logic as to how they claim he disappeared and how his companion survived and how they plucked him out of the ocean bone dry. How is that accomplished? And they get all the media there and they pick him up right at the rescue sites where he's interviewed, 20 miles from shore. And yet you can see the shoreline a few hundred yards away from where the interview is taking place. You know, we don't think, we don't use our brains, our logic when we hear these things. And everybody flocks to a video. I'm not criticizing the person that's tipping us off. It'd be interesting what kind of spin they try to put on the story. That's the point I'm making. Because no, in the original, even... the original story that they did In Search Of, narrated by Leonard Nimoy, produced by Alex Pomasanoff, a Rockefeller stooge, I feel, it's clear that they fudged the photos. Absolutely, without a doubt, they fudged all the photos. In fact, the story about him being involved as part of the crew, the sound recordist, in the movie Dead Birds is also false, because the pictures that represent his being there are also faked. And I urge anyone that doubts that, read The Three Stooges Go to Washington, Parts 7, A, and B. And then watch the Travel Channel story, keeping in mind what I've exposed. And I'm sure it's not going to reveal anything that I've revealed in my research, I can guarantee you. This is damage control. Pure and simple.
Now, well, you know, what I was going to say, which is interesting too, Don, is that the timing is a giveaway. We were only talking about that, what, 2-3 weeks ago? We brought it up again. We have talked about it several times, but quite recently we talked about it.
Uh-huh.
And it's just amazing that they would come out with this now, you know.
Well, there's a note here that the show came out last year, so this may be a rebroadcast. However, the original TV show on In Search Of came out in 1977, and that show was posted on my website, directlightproductions.com. You can click on documentaries, and it's the first most recent film that I put up there. And I analyzed that very carefully, almost frame by frame. And I can tell you, it's very staged. It's almost ridiculous. That's how staged it is. In fact, in many cases, it is ridiculous. And, you know, it raised the question in my mind, why would they fake Michael Rockefeller's death? In 1961, the year Barack Obama or Barry Satoru or whatever name you want to give him was born or professed to have been born. And you were talking about Egyptology. We've been talking about DNA and cloning and eugenics and all of this stuff on many, many shows. All of this ties in. In fact, Dr. Michael Castle agrees with my conclusions. In fact, he said it makes more sense than anything we've been told through the mainstream media. So this is purely damage control. That's all I can say. But, Jim, we got to wrap it up, so I want to give you a final parting comment, if you would.
Well, the amazing thing is, Don, that this hour went flying by, and we've got an awful lot more stuff that I'd like to cover. So with your permission, maybe we could continue in this vein next week.
Absolutely. It would be my pleasure, and I'm sure the listening audience would enjoy it as well.
Very well. I'll be prepared.
Well, Jim, I wish you a great weekend. Be careful on this satanic holiday that has come upon us, and watch out for those sweets if you go trick-or-treating.
I don't think I have any costumes that fit me anymore, but I'll keep that in mind.
Okay. You have a great weekend. I look forward to your appearance next week in the month of November on Evident Footprints.
Okay, Don, thank you.
Okay, folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special guest, scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, teacher, and my co-host, Jim Murray. Join us again next week, and I should say even next month. I've got a great lineup. We're bringing out some new guests. We're going to be doing a few music shows, introducing some new artists. And my Monday night show is going to feature none other than Dr. H.U. Watt. And we're going to shift gears. We're not going to be talking about the flu pandemic. We figured that thing out. We will be getting into some very interesting topics, though, some along the lines of what we touched upon tonight. And I'm sure you're going to find that terribly interesting. Be sure to tell your friends about it. Special thanks also to everyone listening on Wind Talkers Radio Network and Wind Talkers Radio, Radio Network. BlogTalkRadio.com for carrying Evident Footprints either live or in a an archive rebroadcast. Also, special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. I wish everyone a safe and happy holiday and a great weekend. I'll see you next week. In the meantime, have a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.